This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This week, a city marked the passing of former Mayor Kevin White, who led Boston during a decade and a half of transition.
Look at Faneuil Hall. Look at the other areas of our city where he really developed it. He set the blueprint for all of us.
Also in the news this week, another man who wants to build up Boston. But instead of transitioning the face of the city, this developer got caught making illegal campaign contributions to local politicians.
The judge had it right. She treated it for what it was, two misdemeanors, and she fined him $100,000.
Also, the Greenway Conservancy is told to get ready to go it alone by 2019.
This is a fundamental issue about how we as a government spend taxpayer dollars.
And Boston Mayor Tom Menino suggests filling up the big hole in the MBTA budget with a gas tax. Well, joining us now to review the week's news is Ken Cooper, Pulitzer Prize-winning independent journalist and editor of the Trotter Review. Great to see you again, Ken.
Good to see you, Meghna.
Also with us is Peter Canellos, editorial page editor at the Boston Globe. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Meghna.
It's been a long time. Good to have you back.
Thank you.
Well, let's start with the big news of the week, and that is, of course, the passing of former Boston Mayor Kevin White. He was laid to rest on Wednesday after battling Alzheimer's disease for about a decade. Just to remind everyone, he served as mayor from 1968 to 1984, and during that time he did much to transition the entire city of Boston. So first and foremost, Ken, what do you make of the show of support for the legacy of Kevin White we saw this week?
Well, I think there are a great many things about his tenure and his service to the city that are worthy of praise. First of all, he was a public servant for the city, and that's never easy. He did change the physical infrastructure and the physical appearance of the city, and he brought a lot of really talented people into public service with him, some of whom are still making contributions to the city. On the other hand, I don't agree that he made the city a world-class city. Mm-hmm. Cities are cosmopolitan places, and on his watch there was the awful busing crisis that had one group of Bostonians set against another in violent ways, and that's not the kind of thing that goes on in a world-class city.
Peter?
Well, I certainly agree with Ken on the busing era. I think Ken probably agrees also that Kevin White wasn't responsible for the turmoil that was revealed, but it did show that Boston was not world-class under White's tenure. But I think he does get credit for envisioning Boston in the future as a world-class city, and the city has made a lot of great strides in that direction since then.
Well, let's just take on this issue of race and the events that were happening in Boston during Kevin White's tenure. Let's just take it on head on, because one of the people that WBUR spoke to this week, her name's Catherine Earhart Matthew, she had this to say about a particular moment, again, regarding race and Boston's history.
He saved Boston from becoming a natural disaster, the time when Martin Luther King was killed, but he didn't want it to be a major destruction. So he asked the entertainer James Brown if he could do a concert, and it was televised, and that's what saved the city.
Okay, so she's referring to April 1968, when Boston was reported as being one of the cities in the United States that wasn't seized by rioting, largely because the great James Brown was here, and Kevin White encouraged him to go on with the concert, and Boston was riveted by the concert rather than being in the streets. So that's the backstory, but I have to say, we got an email from Diane Walters, who wrote this. Quit talking up that Kevin White, James Brown concert daydream. Boston had riots. They were just contained to the black neighborhoods. And as a resident of the Blue Hill Avenue Grove Hall area, let me tell you, that neighborhood went from a thriving area with multiple small businesses to a boarded up, barren, vacant lot that stretched for miles. So we did some checking on this, and I'll talk about that in a second. But Ken, first, your reaction to this different history about Kevin White's tenure.
Well, I think both things are true, that he did make the effort to have the concert go on in an effort to keep the city calm, the kind of leadership he rarely exercised during the busing crisis. But it is also true, as the emailer says, that there was destruction of business property along the Blue Hill Avenue corridor. And much of that corridor has still yet to rebound into the vital business district that it once was. I mean, this is a different time, and street corridor business districts are harder to sustain than they were back then. But both are true. And I guess someone could argue that had it not been for the concert and the mayor's efforts, the rioting and the destruction of property could have been broader and more damaging.
You know, Peter Canellos, we had Fred Salvucci on the show this week talking about his memories of Kevin White. And actually, on his way out of the studio, he told us a great story that Anthony then later related that... on the one hand, you know, Kevin White received a lot of criticism for how he handled the busing crisis. But on the other hand, a lot of his white critics called him Kevin Black for his support of black neighborhoods in Boston.
Well, that was certainly true. I mean, his posture during the busing crisis was to accept the court order without, you know, fully embracing it and sort of set about restoring law and order or enforcing law and order as the crisis sort of played out. I think that in retrospect, that probably was the least destructive path he could have taken. I think that people on either side can legitimately disagree about whether he should have stood up to the courts or whether he should have more fully embraced it and really cracked down on South Boston and some of the other communities that were revolting. But I think that he showed his concern for the city in trying to broker a middle path. And if you try to envision some of his contemporaries as mayor, people like Frank Rizzo in Philadelphia or the first Mayor Daley in Chicago, it would have been a far greater disaster if we had somebody like that who decided to sort of, you know, take on the powers that be and take on the courts. We would have had the National Guard in Boston. It would have been a disaster. So I think White's management was sound during the crisis.
Well, you know, I mentioned a little bit ago that we actually have a little tape from an eyewitness who was in Boston April 1968. Again, this is vis-a-vis that James Brown concert that happened here and how people said because James Brown performed, there wasn't any rioting in Boston. But we spoke to a man named Bob Hall. He's an associate professor of African American Studies and History at Northeastern. He was at the James Brown concert, but he also said he witnessed rioting in the city on that night. Let's listen.
The story that James Brown saved Boston from having a riot is not literally the case. In the immediate aftermath of the news of King's death, there was a riot up and down Blue Hill Avenue. What White was really seeking to avoid was having the rioting spread to the Central Business District. It's almost as if Roxbury were not considered to be a part of Boston.
So Professor Bob Hall there, an eyewitness to history. Ken and Peter, my last question to you about Mayor White is, you know, he obviously, whatever his legacy is, it's huge. And there was a time where the mayor's office was considered more important than even the governor's office. That seems to have shifted now. So what do you think, Peter, is his lasting legacy in terms of what it means to be mayor of the city of Boston?
Well, he provides a contrast to his two successors, Ray Flynn and Tom Bonino. He was a bold politician. He was a, you know, self-consciously visionary politician. You know, he thought in terms of transforming things. Mayor Flynn and Mayor Menino, who've both been quite effective, are much more nuts and bolts oriented, much more concentrating on the daily governance of the city. And I think that approach has borne a lot of fruit. And I don't really agree that the position of the mayor has diminished. In some ways, Boston is so much more successful today and more economically successful and bigger that it's still a very important job to be mayor. And I think Menino has you know, been a worthy successor to White.
Ken?
Well, I think in some ways, both Menino and Ray Flynn were trying to compensate for things that Kevin White did not do. Mayor Flynn brought the city together. He brought people of color into high positions in his government, which hadn't been done before. Except for Jeep Jones, who was a deputy mayor to Kevin White. And Tom Menino has continued that, and both of them have paid attention to developing the neighborhoods, not just developing downtown. As you recall, in that campaign to replace Kevin White between Ray Flynn and Mel King, there was a lot of discussion about the neglect of neighborhoods because there was so much focus on developing downtown.
Well, Kevin White was of course, the story this week, but there's another little political story that I want to cover before we run out of too much time, and that has to do with money and politics in modern-day Massachusetts, and a Boston developer named Arthur Wynne. He was fined $100,000 this week for illegal campaign contributions he's made to a number of prominent Massachusetts politicians. Arthur Wynne wants to build a major building in Columbus Center in Boston. So basically what he's done is he has admitted to getting friends and family to give money to politicians, But then he reimbursed them, which is what made his actions illegal. He's avoided jail time, but again, that $100,000 fine. Peter Canellos, your thoughts on the Arthur Wynn story and what it says about money and politics in Massachusetts today.
Yeah, well, it says we have to be continuously vigilant about money and politician and yeah, and political influence. I think that this was handled fairly well. I don't think anyone wanted to see Arthur Wynn going to jail. I think it was a scheme, but it wasn't, you know, the most nefarious scheme you've ever heard of. But it was a serious offense, and $100,000 fine is a serious penalty, and I think you know, justice was done.
Ken?
Yeah, I think it was just the justice was done. In the end, he was convicted of two misdemeanors. I mean, there are other things that he had conceded he'd done that were unlawful in the same vein, but statute of limitations, et cetera, had run out. So I think it's a balanced decision. I think it does. I hope it does send a warning to others who might have ideas of circumventing the campaign finance laws that if you do get caught, there are penalties to be paid.
You know, I do wonder, given the vast amounts of money that are circulating through the presidential campaign this year, you know, Arthur Wynn's lawyer points out that his contributions were just minuscule in comparison. But how responsible should we continue to hold politicians for ensuring that the money that their campaigns receive are above board? Or should we be holding them more responsible for doing basically the checking on every dollar that comes into the campaign?
Well, they do a lot of checking because they know if something like this happens, there can be some pushback on them. And they do have certain due diligence requirements under campaign finance laws. I mean, I think the unfortunate thing about now is that what's going on with super PACs is totally lawful, and thus saith the Supreme Court. And the notion that how you spend your money is a matter of freedom of speech if you're a corporation is one that baffles me, but I'm not a Supreme Court justice.
Peter, so I'm going to turn very quickly to one last topic, and that is the Rose Kennedy Greenway, because this week, Transportation Secretary Richard Davey wrote a letter to the Greenway Conservancy that runs the Greenway and said, look, by 2019, you should be ready to run without any state funding. And at this point in time, the Greenway Conservancy receives about half of its budget from the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. So we spoke to Nancy Brennan yesterday, and she said she's going to work with the state towards a solution, but coming up with enough money to run the Greenway as an entirely private organization, she says, would be a bit difficult. Let's listen.
We receive $2.1 million from the state now, and a $60 million fundraising campaign would have to be achieved within 5 years. Even the marquee museums, the Gardner, the ICA, are finding it very hard to reach their endowment goals. I can't imagine. I think it's going to be very difficult practically to have that as a solution.
Peter, it's been a tough couple of weeks for the Greenway Conservancy. What do you make of Secretary Davies' move to say, hey, look, the state is going to start weaning you off funds?
Yeah, I think that there obviously has to be a lot of attention concentrated on how to properly fund the Greenway and whether it should be the city, whether it should be the state, and what role private businesses, whether that should be through a business improvement district or through pure charity as it is right now, or is that there's a component of that now. I think all of those things should be topics for discussion. But we can't forget that the Greenway was part of the Big Dig, which mm-hmm. managed to splurge and waste money on just about everything except what it was supposed to do, which was creating this park. There was no money left by the time everybody had taken their cut of the Big Dig share of things. So the state does bear a responsibility for making sure that that park is developed to its full potential. And I don't think Rick Chavie is right to suggest that the state's already done enough.
Ken?
Well, I tend to go side with Rick Davey on this one. I mean, if the state wants to take full responsibility for it and put it under the Department of Conservation and Recreation, that would be one thing. It's state-owned land. But if you have a private entity that has this separate bureaucratic infrastructure to oversee the park and the state's financing that in his own park directorates, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I think they should be weaned off in a way that's rational and doable and makes sense and maybe takes longer than 10 years. But I think either they should be weaned off or it should be a state-run, state-managed park straight out of the state treasury.
Well, there's a lot of moving parts to this story, and we'll keep up with them. But for now, the last thing we have time for is our weekly hubbub, and that's the stories that didn't make it above the proverbial fold. And Anthony, your hubbub?
Yeah, my hubbub comes down to a basic lesson that those of us who have worked in radio for some time have learned in painful ways. And basically it comes down to this. When you're sitting behind a microphone, even if you think it's off, don't say anything that you wouldn't want to be broadcast because that mic might just be on after all. I mean, remember Ronald Reagan? He famously said to the Russians long ago, "We start bombing in 10 minutes." He said it in front of a microphone that he thought was off. So all this brings me to a mistake made by the student editors at the Suffolk University Journal this week. In the current issue, they had to apologize for a profane headline that actually went to print. Apparently, it was written as an in-house joke, but it slipped through the final editing process and actually went to print. And it refers to a constituency on campus, I guess we could say, in terms that I can't actually say on this program because, well, this is a family program, but here's the lesson.
And the FCC could be listening.
Right. If you see a microphone, it's probably on. If you see a video camera, you're probably being filmed. And if you compose what you intend to be a fake headline, and you newspaper guys can probably back me up on this, watch out because it just might end up being published.
That's never happened to you, Peter, right?
Well, it's happened at the Globe. It's not happened to me, but there was a very famous one during the Carter administration. I'm sure Ken remembers that, too, where an editorial went through with "More Mush from the Wimp" was the joke headline. That made it through, and that's a famous moment.
So you can say that on this show. You can't say what ended up in the Suffolk Journal, but it's pretty funny.
It's a legendary moment. Are you asking for my hubbub?
Yeah, your hubbub.
Yeah, okay. There's a Cambridge man who is suing Massachusetts for its state seal, which he says is denigrating to Native Americans. As most people know, the seal shows a Native American with a bow and arrow pointing downwards to symbolize peace. Above it, however, there's a sword, which happens to be a symbol of the Minutemen and was added more than 100 years after the Indian symbol. Nonetheless, this man is saying that conveys a sense of violence towards Native Americans. You know, there's sensitivities, obviously, and no one should rule out the possibility of ever updating the state seal. But I think that, you know, society's at a moment now where people can appreciate the history and the rather good intentions that went into both of those symbols. The first one, the Indian symbol dating from 1629, a very respectful symbol. So the state seal shouldn't be changed.
Hmm. Ken Cooper, your hubbub.
Mine's a little more serious. The Boston school superintendent, Carolyn Johnson, has engaged in a series of meeting too far with what are being called elders of Boston's black community. And what is essentially going on, she met earlier this week with some black business leaders, she's asking for help. She's basically acknowledging that the school system by itself cannot close achievement gap with respect to black students if there aren't other resources brought to bear. And it's kind of a refreshing and kind of a humble thing that she's doing.
Well, that is Ken Cooper, Pulitzer Prize-winning independent journalist and editor of the Trotter Review, rounding out our hubbubs today. Ken, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Peter Canellos, editorial page editor at the Boston Globe. Great to talk to you as always, Peter.
Good to talk to you, Magna.
And stay with us. Up next, a bit of New England football history and the incredible transformation of the once humble ragtag Patriots into an NFL powerhouse. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Magna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.